Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Norbert Brunhuber. I am the host today for The Briefing Room, the Healthcare Association's podcast series. I currently work with Vertex Pharmaceuticals, and I'm one of the people who are on the committee, the Foresight Committee, that helps put together these podcasts. But the star today, of course, is my guest, a former colleague of mine from Vertex. Michael Oliver is currently the general manager of Novartis Gene Therapies for the Northern European Cluster. And I'd like to give him a moment to introduce himself.
Thanks, Norbert. Yes, as you mentioned, Michael Oliver, General Manager for the Northern European Cluster, which is UK, Ireland and the Nordics for Novartis Gene Therapies. I've been in the industry over 30 years. I spent sort of the first 25 of those in big organizations, MSD, AstraZeneca and GlaxoSmithKline. And over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, I've worked in smaller companies, Vertex and also Sobi. And I'm currently at Novartis, looking after the gene therapies portfolio for Northern Europe.
Great. Can you tell us, though, also the sector that you were in over the course of those companies, broadly speaking?
Well, actually, I've been very fortunate to have worked across many different therapy areas. So, you know, I started my career, you could say, in sort of large primary care therapy areas like cardiovascular disease, like respiratory, and also areas like diabetes as well. More recently, I focused very much on rare diseases. So much of the last 15 or so years, I've worked in rare diseases, so pulmonary hypertension, cystic fibrosis, hematology, immunology, neurological conditions like spinal muscular atrophy, and also rare retinal disorders as well.
Got you. And was this always from the commercial perspective that you were working on these different areas?
I've always, I guess, had a commercial badge. However, when I did work at GlaxoSmithKline in their global commercial strategy division in respiratory, actually we sat in R&D. So we were the commercial part of R&D, where we provided input into the clinical trial design, the sort of the broad sort of strategy for the areas that we're wanting to do R&D in, the therapy areas, the different treatment options, et cetera. So that technically did sit in R&D, but it was a commercial role.
Yeah, excellent. All right, with that backdrop, I think that helps everybody understand the perspective that you're coming from. And so let's explore some of the topics that you and I thought you could speak about when it comes to healthcare communications to different types of stakeholders. And so the first topic we're going to talk about is the advent of gene therapies. So gene therapy is an extremely important field. It's emerging, but it's also gotten very big at the same time within the pharmaceutical business and also in the biotech world. It's remarkably different from the typical small molecule therapies that we traditionally associate with the pharmaceutical industry. And that has to do with the complexity of the medication itself, but perhaps also the way that patients need to be treated because of that complexity. And so I'd be interested to hear what you think is important when it comes to those kinds of therapies, and how does that dynamic change the way we need to communicate with healthcare stakeholders?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is an area which is hugely exciting. If I sort of think back to, you know, being a pharmacology student back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, what we can do now with gene therapies, the ability to affect a human gene is science fiction. And what we, or you know, looking back in those days, people would have thought it was science fiction. It's incredible how far we have come. And I guess also in the fact that about 80% of rare diseases are of genetic origin, and that's a key area of investment, scientific discovery across pharma and biotech companies. You know, this whole area of gene therapies is incredibly exciting. However, it is complex. There's a huge amount of complexity when it comes to gene therapies. And really, from a communications perspective, that adds, I guess, challenges, but also opportunities. So if you think of, you know, typically with a gene therapy, one of the first steps in any treatment pathway is the diagnosis. Is effectively diagnosing a patient. Many gene therapies are intended for children, because that is the, you know, the majority of 80% of genetic diseases affect children. So the diagnosis is important. Then it is actually the communication with the patient and or parent stroke carer, especially in relation to children, and the how that communication is delivered, the importance of simply communicating and delivering very complex messages very, very simply. Close working with the multidisciplinary team who are going to be making very important decisions. What's quite unique about gene therapies is typically they are one-off interventions. Mm. They're a one-off treatment which corrects or replaces a mutated or faulty gene. And therefore, you know, it is a one-off treatment. And the importance of the multidisciplinary team taking an important decision, engaging with the parent or the patient themselves. The actual delivery of the gene therapy is also highly complex because of the transportation conditions, you know, that are required. And then also any sort of additional tests that need to be undertaken with the patient to ensure the gene therapy is appropriate. So, for example, with viral vectors, you need to do some antibody testing to ensure that the patient is going to have an adverse reaction, you know, to the viral vector delivery methodology. And then, you know, once the infusion has taken place or the treatment has taken place, then it's the follow-up care, you know, with the patient and with the family as well. So with all that, the communication that's required with those different stakeholders, and really importantly with all of this, is making sure that highly complex scientific messages are delivered in a simple, easy to understand manner for a range of different stakeholders, from the patient, if that's appropriate, the parents or a caregiver, the healthcare professionals, the, you know, the whole multidisciplinary team, people involved in the supply chain, and then also the follow-up aftercare as well, which is all key steps on that sort of treatment pathway.
Yeah, this is very interesting. The way you phrased it, it kind of made me feel like there's an entire ecosystem that is evolved in when treating somebody with a complex medication like this.
100%.
Yeah. And so consequently, at the same time, it's also, as you mentioned, probably a lot more difficult to explain because of the complexity of the product compared to what people are used to. And so the challenge becomes, like, how do you maintain that kind of level of communication with such a diverse group of people in that ecosystem where they need to depend on one another to make it all work well?
Yeah. So I think for me, a lot of it is about taking highly complex science, real innovation in what we're now able to do with genes, replacement or modifying genes, the advent of things like CRISPR technology, which has only just been approved in the US, and also in the UK, which is also hugely exciting. It's taking that highly complex science and packaging it in a simple way, but also having tailoring the messages to the audience as well.
Right.
Because clearly, you know, having a conversation with a professor of genetics is one thing. And of course, you can then go into the real detail and the science and you know, ensure you do not understate the value of what you're talking about. But at the same time, having a simplified version of that story for parents or children who are potentially going to be on the receiving end of you know, gene therapies. And it's really tailoring the messaging, but also as well as the messaging, thinking about the channels by which we communicate as well. And you know, typically, you know, I guess historically the industry has been very focused on sort of face-to-face interactions. Mm. You know, I think COVID changed that. And that we're now using sort of virtual interactions is much more common and actually preferred by many healthcare professionals, but also making sure we're not missing the opportunity with other channels. You know, social media is especially important when it comes to patient associations, when it comes to patients and parents, sort of, you know, caregivers. It's the use of sort of websites, email, etc., and making sure we're thinking about all the different channels. But importantly, when it comes to omnichannel, it's really putting the end receiver, I guess you could say the customer, right at the heart of that, and thinking about what is the best method of communication for that individual. And usually it's not just one channel, it's multiple channels. And it's thinking about how do we make it suitable for that individual, and having the different channels talking to each other, but also making sure the messaging is appropriate as well and tailored to the audience.
So you're mentioning the two key things that always I find fascinating. One is, how do you work with the content depending on the stakeholder, but then also what vehicle do you use to communicate that content? So it's like two halves of it. So, and you mentioned both of those, but I'd like to dig a little deeper on both a little bit, if I may. In particular, about the, let's start with the content side of it. So you mentioned, you know, have a complex product, perhaps even a complex diagnosis pathway. You know, when these things are so rare, potentially. What kind of approaches have you and your team used in the past to help try to dissect how to evolve pieces of the content to make it appropriate for different stakeholders?
I think you start off with the customer, you know, with the end user, and really think about that individual or that group of individuals. And you know, there are lots of ways of trying to get insights behind those people. Yeah, the traditional methodologies like market research, etc. But often having specific questions, one-on-one interactions with these groups or individuals to really understand what their needs are, what vehicles that they prefer from a communication perspective. So I think a lot of it starts with gaining insights and looking at how to gain those insights. And you know, clearly, when you're thinking about different customer groups or different types of customers, you know, there are different ways of gaining those insights. Sometimes it's through things like market research. Sometimes it's through surveys. Sometimes it's through one-on-one interactions, and simply just asking, you know, what is the best way to interact? You know, certainly I find that, you know, important when dealing with say patient associations and key stakeholders and patient associations, and just, you know, just having that sort of what I call adult conversation. Say, what's the best way to communicate with you? What's the best way to keep you updated with what's going on? Is it email? Is it a verbal briefing? You know, what is the best methodology for that?
Yeah, I think that's such a great point, actually, is to not be afraid or to think that you have to know it all. Is this actually right. Just talk to the people and they'll be very happy to tell you in most cases. And in fact, I find, tell me if you agree, I find that when you have those conversations, you also can ask them, what is it that you want to know about? You know,
right.
Or what is it that you think is not so well understood?
Right, exactly. And actually, I think a couple of things. One is that just building what you've just said, wise is the person who knows what he or she doesn't know. Okay. So I think it's a sign of strength to put your hand up and say, I don't know the answer to that question. And to actually sort of, you know, elicit it from someone. But also it is asking for that and also thinking about how that is tailored. For example, you know, we've had a request from a clinician to have data and information and scientific information which is packaged and suitable to then to be given to patients, so that, you know, to help that clinician then communicate a highly complex topic but in simple plain English so that a patient or a parent can understand that, and actually having that sort of, again, that sort of adult dialogue to understand, okay, what do you need, how can we help you, and then providing the solution.
Mm-hmm. Do you find people are very receptive to those kind of inquiries that you make?
I think especially when you work in sort of rare diseases where you tend to deal with, you know, a small audience, a small clinical community, a small patient community, a relatively small sort of, you know, group of stakeholders, there tends to be greater receptivity to those sort of conversations. I think it's more difficult. If I think back to, you know, earlier on in my career when I was working sort of to large primary care therapy areas, cardiovascular disease, respiratory, etc. You're dealing with general practitioners. That's more difficult to have sort of the one-on-one insight because you've got, you know, tens of thousands of GPs, you know, across the UK. You can't understand what each individual's preferred methodology, but you can look at ways of eliciting that information from market research, surveys, etc. And just, you know, searching for data to help to inform you about the decisions you want to make about the channels you use.
Mm-hmm. What do you find more difficult working with a smaller community? Like you mentioned how it's convenient because you can talk to people one-on-one, which I agree is great. But what perhaps is the difference when it comes to comparing it to large products that you have a big healthcare population you have to deal with?
Well, I think working rare disease where you deal with, tend to deal with a small clinical community, a small patient community, but also a community that is very well connected and also works across boundaries, works across borders. So you typically, with a lot of rare diseases, you have European fora, European groups, because it's a small community and the communication happens, across geographies, far more. And I think, that obviously provides an opportunity, but also there are some challenges when you're dealing with a small community, because, I guess if you get things right, you can get things very right. But also if you get things wrong, you can get things very wrong. Yeah. So you can kind of win big or lose big. So therefore, the stakes can be a wee bit higher. Yeah. But also, I think the opportunity with the smaller communities is to have much more tailoring to the messaging, to the delivery, et cetera, versus when you are working in a much broader community, say primary care, et cetera, then it's much more difficult then to tailor the messaging, because you've got such a broad audience as well. And of course, you will try and segment your customers and try to look at how you can have some sort of tailoring, but it's more difficult to do it with a much bigger community.
Yeah, I think it also, when you're dealing with people so closely, your emotional intelligence is just as important as the data that you have.
Exactly. And I think this is, when you think about communication, you've got to leverage IQ as well as EQ with communication. and I think that's so important. And that's actually interesting, because, one of the learnings from COVID, actually, when you think about prior to COVID, the vast majority of our interactions were face-to-face, right? Mm-hmm. And in face-to-face, the richness of the information you can get from the face, from the body language, how people communicate, it makes it easier to communicate. Then all of a sudden we went into COVID, you're dealing with someone in two dimensions. So you lose a lot of information. And also what people found as well was you're working a lot harder. Your eyes are working harder, your brain is working harder, because you're trying to analyze a 2D image to get as much information as possible about how the person you're communicating is responding to your messaging. So I think the EQ and thinking about the emotional intelligence is really, really important when you're thinking about communication.
Yeah, totally agree. So you, going then onto the vehicle side of the equation, you mentioned omnichannel, which is, of course, the big buzzword and a very worthy goal. How you being on the commercial side, perhaps you can answer this. How do you see omnichannel in pharmaceuticals being different from omnichannel in something like packaged goods or the airline industry, which we traditionally kept being held to as the standard? Right. But I question if whether that connection is really as strong as it ought to be.
Yeah, so I think that the principles should be the same, i.e., putting the customer at the heart of the communication, thinking about the channels that he or she are best suited, and tailoring the messages through the different channels, etc. So I think that the broad principles are fair. However, and this is a very big however, we work in one of the most regulated industries that there is, for very good reason. Because we deal with highly innovative breakthrough medicines, drugs, which, if you get that wrong, the consequences can be catastrophic. And therefore, it is highly appropriate that we are a highly regulated industry. How we communicate, what we can communicate, to whom we can communicate, needs to be really, really carefully thought through. And therefore, that applies to, how we communicate, the channels that we use, and to whom we communicate. And therefore, to have to position it as being too similar to, say, to the airline industry or whatever, I think that it needs a bit of caution in my mind when it comes to that, because we do have to apply a filter of, okay, what would we like to be able to do, and then what is it appropriate for us to them to be able to do, and often there is a delta between those two goals.
Yeah, 100%. I think, comparing ourselves to something like an airline, website is just going to set yourself up for disappointment, and unjustly so,
Right.
At the same time, I often hear, oh, compliance won't let us do omnichannel, so we give up, which isn't the right answer either, I feel. You do have to try to find that creative ways to work with your colleagues to try to make something approaching what the ideal is for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I think interesting on that, and actually, this is where I think the role of compliance has really, in my mind, has evolved over the last 15, 20, 30 years. So, again, if I think back to the start of my career, compliance was, I would say, a disabler. They were very focused on what you can't do. But if I think about the experience I've had, especially in the last 10, 15 years, and the compliance colleagues I've worked with, they've very much been what I'd call enablers. They've very much come with a perspective of, well, actually, you know what? We have to be careful about doing this for these reasons, and we expose ourselves to these risks. If you were to do A, B, and C, actually you mitigate those risks. So therefore you can still achieve many of the goals of what you're trying to achieve. However, what you do that in a more compliant way. and you minimize, you know, the risks that they would expose yourself to. So I think, you know, my experience is certainly in the last, like I said, yeah, 5, 10, 15 years working with compliance colleagues, I see them as being a critical part of the team and actually being enablers rather than disablers, which is a really important mindset shift.
Sure. And then it becomes a matter of working together as opposed to having an antagonistic relationship, which is helpful to no one.
Exactly. And like I said, you know, when I was a brand manager back in the 1990s, I think, you know, the relationship was quite antagonistic, to
Yeah.
be brutally honest.
Sure.
It was a disabling sort of relationship. And I think the mindset on all sides was wrong. Whereas now I think, you know, we've come a long way. There've been some unfortunate case studies in the industry where compliance has gone wrong. And I think we've all learned from those. And I think it's also, you know, thinking that compliance is a responsibility of everyone. You know, you don't need to have a medical degree to understand the code of practice in the UK. You know, yes, you need to have a medical or a pharmacy degree to be a sort of a signatory, but actually, you know, you don't need to have spent 5 years at medical school to know something's right or something's wrong. We're all accountable for understanding the codes of practice, and we're all accountable for making, you know, value judgments on what we believe is appropriate or not appropriate. And we shouldn't need to rely on compliance colleagues to tell us, no, you can't do that.
Yeah. Totally agree. That's great. That's great advice. Let me wrap up this segment by maybe can you give us some examples of where you've had personal experience where omnichannel has worked, to a degree anyway, without divulging any, proprietary information?
I think where I've seen it working has been when you are dealing with multiple different stakeholders and you are looking at different methodologies and vehicles to communicate with those stakeholders. And it's tailoring different channels to the customer, but also making sure the channels talk to each other. So it's very simple things like, you know, for example, having sort of, you know, one-on-one interactions through a representative, either, you know, virtually or face to face, which is then followed up with an email, which then links to a website, which then links to follow-up information, potential invites to a meeting, yeah, et cetera. And then you try to have ensure that you from one interaction, which is the initial sort of face to face or virtual face to face interaction, you then link it into many other channels to really augment the messaging, so there are multiple opportunities for the message that is wanting to be communicated can be delivered to that recipient.
Yeah. So the point is, though, we've come a long way in the industry, and omnichannel is perhaps maturing as a concept, and
Right.
you have seen it be able to be implemented at least to a certain degree. I mean, it is possible. I'm trying to give people a message of hope here that they should to try to attempt this for themselves.
Yes, it is possible. And also the beauty of omnichannel is it's measurable as well. Because clearly, when you are implementing a new campaign, a new strategy, you want to be able to measure, you know, the lead and lag measurements, you know, KPIs from what you're doing. So are you know, able to deliver the message? Are people then clicking through into other websites or whatever, seeking more information, attending meetings, etc. So you've got various sort of lead measures to look at how effective the omnichannel, the different channels are. But then, of course, you know, you can then look at sort of, you know, sort of lag measures like sales impact, use of your product, etc. And then try to sort of to circle back to say, okay, can you then differentiate between the value of different channels, which channel is having a bigger impact than the others? That's more difficult, but I think that those types of analyses are becoming more and more possible.
Do you feel like you could do some testing though, where you artificially cut a spoke out of the omnichannel wheel and see how it
Absolutely.
works? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, people talk about sort of A/B testing, where you can test different messaging, different methodologies, different channels. And then to see, you know, what the difference of effect you get when you try different routes, different messages, you know, et cetera. So there is the opportunity to, you know, to experiment.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Right. Let's talk about our next segment, which is interesting because it talks a bit about us as a pharmaceutical industry, where in the past, perhaps, we focused very heavily on treating disease, because we had products to sell that treat that disease. On the other hand, we also are in a world where prevention actually is the best way to a cure. And we've always heard this sort of thing from our physicians, probably on a personal level, where eating better, exercising more, et cetera, would lead to a lot of solutions to the problems that we're having. But I think this is also changing in the healthcare space, where companies are more interested in trying to help people treat the disease through preventing it in the first place and have some approaches that are different from just treating the disease directly. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience in this area?
So I think this is it's a really, really important area because there is a big focus on treatment. If you think about how many medicines are praised through HTA bodies, gaining reimbursement, a lot of the focus there is about treating the condition and treating the symptomatology. There's less emphasis on the prevention of events that are going to happen in the future. And especially if events are happening in the, not near future, the long-term future, say 20, 30 years time, where you're preventing potentially death in that time period and you're extending life, say 20 or 30 years in the future. When you apply that to a health technology appraisal through the cost effectiveness and health economic arguments, the value of preventing something in the future, a long time in the future, is worth very little in today's money. And therefore, the ability to demonstrate cost effectiveness in some of those areas can be challenging. I think gene therapies, it does to a certain extent link to this as well, because, many gene therapies are able to effectively stop the progression of a condition, but it can't undo the damage that's been done already. So it can't reverse that. And actually, this is where intervening really early when it comes to many gene therapies can help provide far better outcomes, because it prevents the disease from manifesting itself and it prevents the consequences of that disease. And just drilling into that a little more. And thinking about the rare diseases space, and probably the biggest challenge in rare diseases is actually diagnosing the patients. People talk about the diagnostic odyssey, where it can take several years for patients to be diagnosed. I think it's estimated that a third of patients take at least 5 years to get a diagnosis, and that's why the rare diseases framework in the UK, the number one priority is about having effective diagnosis faster. For patients, and I guess when thinking about gene therapies, that also then links into things like newborn screening, because when you have a genetic condition where the diagnosis requires a genetic test, and if you've got an effective treatment which can correct a mutated gene, for example, then actually it's in everyone's best interest to be able to diagnose that patient as early as possible. And things like newborn screening become really, really important in that area. And this is an area where actually we see huge diversity across Europe, for example,
yes,
in how many treatments are screened. The UK is one of the countries towards the bottom end, where we only screen for 9 conditions. Wow. Whereas, quite recently, Sweden, for example, approved screening for spinal muscular atrophy. And when they added spinal muscular atrophy to the panel back in September of 2023, that became the 26th condition that's included in the newborn screening. So there's a real delta there, in relation to how countries embrace newborn screening and what conditions are included in there. But the potential to intervene, especially with gene therapies, really early in the patient, the baby's life, to help prevent the consequences of the disease, it has huge implications from a benefit and well-being for the patient, for the parents and the carers, the ability for the patient to live as close to a normal life as possible, and I guess linked to all that will be all the costs associated with the need to treat the symptoms, the disease progression, the cost of healthcare, but also the cost of societal care as well. Because when you think about the ability for parents to have to care for their children, not working, not being able to pay taxes, the societal burden that then leads to as well, there's quite a a complexity there in relation to the consequences of not preventing the disease manifestations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, absolutely agree with this. When it comes to that, though, when is you as a pharmaceutical industry person try to communicate on prevention rather than treatment to stakeholders? And I'm talking about, broadly speaking, the patient or caregiver, the treating physician, but also the payers, let's say. You know, how well received are you as in that role comparative to what they're used to, more used to seeing?
Well, I think you think about some of the areas that I'm working in at the moment, like spinal muscular atrophy, for example. I think the clinical community, there's clinical data showing, the benefit of early intervention, pre-symptomatic, in the newborn population. So the clinical community are, in general, very receptive because they can see the benefits. And also they can see the consequences of intervening later. So if you allow a disease to sort of manifest itself,
right,
the devastating implications they can have on, on the babies, the children, etc. So I think that community is very receptive. Also, the patient community and the patient support networks also tend to be very receptive as well, because again, they're looking at the human cost, the human impact of intervening early, preventing consequences, etc. I think the payer arguments are more challenging. Because what you are asking for is investment today to prevent something in the future, and I think that's where the health economic arguments come into play. That's where some of the challenges start to incur. Because if you're preventing issues, complications, disease manifestations, death in the future, then you bring that back to a health economic analysis today, and you apply a discount rate for benefits you're going to show in many years to come. That makes it more difficult to demonstrate the cost effectiveness by the analyses that are used today with the health economic arguments.
So is it, because I'm not as close to that segment of healthcare as perhaps you are, so I'm very curious about it. Do you think it's that they understand that you're going to be reducing these other ancillary healthcare costs by preventing the disease earlier? And therefore, then it's more a question of just whether what you're asking for your product is in line with that. Is that the really argument? Or do they question whether it's really going to help them down the line as well in the first instance? Like, what's the hesitation with them?
I think payer decision makers, so HTA bodies, they have an incredibly difficult job, because they are often having to manage finite budgets, having to make decisions, have to make trade-off decisions. And that is not easy. That is not easy at all. And therefore, they have to adopt a certain methodology to how they then assess and appraise the value of an intervention. And I think this is where some of the challenges really start to manifest when you're dealing in rare diseases. You're dealing with treatments treating a small population, but also you're dealing with conditions which deliver significant benefit in the future. When many of these HTA assessments were set up, they were set up in the early sort of late 90s, early noughties, and often they were dealing with broad sort of primary care type interventions, cardiovascular disease, asthma, COPD, etc., which you're dealing with sort of millions of patients rather than hundreds of patients. And when you start bringing the focus down to rare diseases, to small populations, to preventing manifestations, complications of the disease in the future, it's then very difficult using this methodology to demonstrate the cost effectiveness and the value of these treatments. So that's where things can become quite challenging. And I think we've seen that with some very high profile negotiations between companies and payer government authorities, in recent years, when the way that the assessments were being undertaken made it very difficult for those treatments to get or to demonstrate cost effectiveness by that methodology.
Mm-hmm. It becomes more of a collectively between the payers and the pharmaceutical community, perhaps a way to try to evolve the thinking for having models that work better with a very unique set of circumstances compared to what the typical pharmaceutical product is asking for.
Exactly. And I then think also when you're looking at things like newborn screening, for example, you have different stakeholder groups in different countries. There's typically, that's not necessarily a payer body that's making the newborn screening decision. There tends to be, for example, in the UK, there's a national screening committee that looks at your newborn screening across, all different areas. And they sit outside of payer bodies, et cetera. So you have a different stakeholder to then engage with. It's not always totally clear exactly where their accountability sits and who they're accountable to, and therefore trying to communicate, engage, try to encourage change, inclusion of new therapy areas and new diseases to be included in newborn screening. You get added complexities when it comes to communication with some of those bodies.
Yeah. Okay. Understood. Going back to something that you said earlier, which I found very interesting, which is you said physicians and even patient associations, especially in the rare disease space, they are more receptive to kind of these prevention type messages that you come along with. And I think, and I'm inferring here what you said, but I think what you were implying is that because they know the consequences regardless. So yes, we may be taking some risks about this prevention ahead of time, especially when it's new to the market or what have you, but we definitely know what's going to happen if we don't do anything. So let's maybe give it a chance. So I can understand that they're using they're being steeped in it every day to help give context to that decision.
Exactly. And I think what's really important as well is that, there's been a real, I guess, explosion in treatments for rare diseases in the last 15, 20 years. Yeah. And that's been driven by, our better understanding of genetics, of immunology, and many other sort of areas of science, which has really exploded our understanding. And then our ability then to develop highly innovative, specific medicines to help to treat these rare diseases. So many clinicians who are practicing today in rare diseases have operated in an environment where there were no treatments. Cystic fibrosis is an example. Paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria is another example, where these are rare diseases where, prior to the advent of treatments which have been available in the last 10, 15 years, the life expectancy of people diagnosed with these conditions was not great. The consequence of these conditions was highly traumatic and devastating. And these clinicians have got hands-on experience of seeing, people dying because there hasn't been effective treatments. And now, with the advent of treatment, they can see it's light and day versus, the tools at their disposal, or the data that they've seen in clinical trials. Perhaps if they've even been involved in clinical trials themselves, can see the huge impact that these treatments have had on patients. So they've got their own sort of personal experience of, with and without these treatments. So therefore, I think, that brings a certain more emotive mindset from the clinical community, because they've got real hands-on experience about why these treatments are so effective and so impactful.
Yeah, agreed. But do we run a risk then when it comes to perhaps new physicians, when the initial wave of these patients, mature, and then it's just everybody is essentially now in the new era? I'd love to hear how you feel that's going to be a new communication challenge with both newer physicians, new to the field, but also perhaps with the parents who are being asked to do some really radical stuff, perhaps to their child. Right. Without any experience of this horrible part of the disease's history.
Yeah, interesting one about the clinicians. And I think this is where, it's important we don't lose sight of the natural history of these diseases, the conditions. We share that information, with the next generation of consultants, of experts, etc. I don't think that should be too difficult. I think, that's really important, but we still make sure that people are made aware of the consequences of the disease they've left untreated. That's, really important. And that's a key role that we have. And then I think when it comes to the parents and to the patients, again, it's making sure that we educate them about the consequences of the natural history of these conditions, and that without these treatments, this is what could happen, and this is what has happened in the past. And I think that's, hugely impactful. But also, if I take a little bit of a step back and I think about, why do I do the job that I do today? It's because I want to make a difference to patients' lives. That's why I joined the industry over 30 years ago, is to be working for innovative organizations that bring life-changing, life-saving medicines to patients. And for me to play a small role in that process, it's hugely important, and also gives me a real sense of purpose in why I do what I do. And that's why, you reflect back on, without treatments, think about, cardiovascular disease, cardiovascular disease without statins, for example. Where would we be? And the advent in rare diseases, without some of the breakthrough treatments we've had in many areas, spinal muscular atrophy, cystic fibrosis, many other areas where, the prognosis was pretty horrendous before the advent of some of these highly innovative breakthrough therapies.
I totally agree. I think that the line we walk, though, is to not be perceived as being scaremongers as well.
Yeah, I think it's always a trade-off, and I think this is, I guess this is how we communicate it, because I guess the information is the information, to be brutally honest. So how do we package it? How do we communicate it? How do we then tailor that message to a patient, body, etc., versus how we package it to a clinician, how we package it to a health technology appraisal body, as well, because, often going in with a highly emotive, narrative with an HTA body isn't necessarily going to work particularly well, because they will be focusing much more on the cost effectiveness, the clinical data, the health economic data, etc. That's what is driving them, and they're less likely to respond to a highly emotive set of messaging about the patient impact and the patient benefit.
Yeah, I agree. And that goes back to, again, having to understand your audiences, what's important to them, using the channels that are important to them. It's just doing this to wrap this segment up. I think it's with talking about prevention, it just is a different communication challenge, but using the same basic principles of how to do good communication. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And I think it's really thinking about the message you want to communicate. It's not about, treating a condition. It's about preventing the consequences, pre preventing the impact, and it's the messaging that is communicated. I guess a lot of the channels would be pretty similar, but it's thinking about the narrative, the messaging, and how that is communicated, and also tailoring that to your audience.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, we talked a bit about some of the different ways that the pharmaceutical industry is evolving the way they communicate with a whole host of different healthcare stakeholders. But as to do all that is the internal team within the pharmaceutical company. And that means that a number of different people need to work together and have to express different types of viewpoints and contribute solutions to make the best possible communication package that you can put together. Tell us a little bit about what you think is important when it comes to putting together that kind of a team inside of a company and the role of a leader in particular to help foster that team's success.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest learnings I've had in my career, is, from a leadership perspective, ultimately it is all about the people. And actually, if you have that mindset in how you approach leadership and how you approach, the teams that you work with, that will stand you in good stead. And I guess, taking a bit of a step back, if you think about what actually is an organization, what is a company, in its most basics of your construct, it is people and it is products. Of course, you've got finances and you've got buildings and other bits and pieces, but ultimately it's your people and your products. The difference between good and outstanding is always the people that make the difference. And therefore, the role of a leader is absolutely critical in creating an environment where you have the right people, but also you have an environment where those people can do their best work, where you create an environment where you have real clarity about what we're needing to achieve. You have real clarity about making sure the people, have got the skills and the capabilities that are required to deliver what they've been asked to deliver. You give them the freedom, you give them the empowerment to get on and deliver. The regular ways of checking in, checkpoints to see, you know, are we winning or losing? And if we're losing, how do we course correct? And if we're winning, how do we celebrate? And then, you know, continuing to build that a positive environment, you know, with the individuals, with the team. And a lot of that actually starts with who the team is. You know, how do you construct a team? And really thinking about having a diverse group of people. You know, another thing that which I've learned as well, which is if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And actually thinking about when you're building a team, thinking about having a really diverse set of people of, you know, different genders, you know, different ethnicities, different backgrounds, different perspectives, and really embracing, you know, diversity. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of progress made in that area, but I think there's still a lot more that we can do to really making sure we're really thinking about diversity and also equity and inclusion when it comes to that. And it's the richness of the team that really helps you deliver some fantastic work. And actually making sure that in that team you have a diversity of thought, diversity of thinking. Because if everyone agrees with everything, you don't need a team, you just need one person.
Yeah.
Having those challenging arguments, those challenging discussions, you know, to really get people to think differently is so, so important.
How have you seen it done well to get people to contribute when they're not so comfortable in doing so, perhaps because they're not in the majority?
Well, I think you need to create a greater safe environment. And that's easier said than done.
Yes.
But I think it is creating a safe environment where, you know, there's no such thing as a stupid question. It's encouraging people to speak up. It's actually also, you know, thinking about individual social styles. So some people are reflectors, some people are quite sort of, introvert. They never want to be the first person to talk, for example. They want to sit back and listen and observe, and sometimes miss the opportunity to contribute. And mm-hmm. I guess as a leader, just really thinking about, you know, who's in my team? Who are the people in my team? How does he or she operate? How does he or she think? And then making sure that you're encouraging them, you're inviting them to contribute, and also supporting them in doing that. You know, if that means, you know, if you've got someone who is very reflective, who needs a bit of time to think, you know, perhaps before the meeting, you have a quick word with that individual and say, look, these are some of the things I'm going to be discussing. I really value your thoughts. Why don't you start thinking about this now so that when we have the meeting, please come with your thoughts, come with
That's
your
fantastic.
Ideas. And I will encourage you to contribute. So these are some sort of, you know, areas to think about.
I love that idea. That's a fantastic idea. I could tell you how many times, even when it's reviewing data, I'm not the kind of person, like I don't mind having a little bit of overview of like a big data presentation, you know, to give me some orientation, but to think about it deeply and to give you some valuable contributions back, I need to actually look at that deck for some time by myself.
Right.
And so you're preemptively doing that so that when they come to the meeting that they have done that kind of reflection time and then can become prepared to speak. I would welcome that personally. And I love that contribution.
Yeah, because actually another thing which I remember, I was given this feedback when I wasn't being particularly vocal in various fora, etc. And I remember an old manager of mine saying to me, you know, what are you thinking but not saying? What mm-hmm. are you thinking but not saying? Mm-hmm. And actually, I often, if I'm in a meeting and I'm not contributing, I'll often sort of just pause and think, gosh, what am I thinking? Why aren't I contributing? To really, you know, think about that. And then, you know, give myself permission to say something, and also just being comfortable with the fact that if you contribute, it may not necessarily be the best contribution, but you are still asking something, you're raising a point, and you have equal right to make a contribution in the meeting.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like being a leader, you really need to invest in the people that are on your team. And this doesn't mean just people that directly report to you, but even in the matrix environment, you have to be very active, and not just like active in that you're making decisions and making things happen, but active in trying to elicit the best out of the people that you're working with.
Exactly. And I think with that, it goes back to the point about diversity and really thinking about, you know, who we have in our teams, people from different backgrounds, different walks of life, different genders, different race, different sexualities, people with different levels of ability, disability, etc. And really just making sure you're thinking about that perspective. And when teams are being built, to try to really think about, have we really got a diverse group of individuals? Yeah, and actually, when you are doing things like recruitment, are you actually encouraging people from different backgrounds, to apply for roles? Is your interview panel, just white men, for example? Because
Right.
if it is, then perhaps you might get people who don't fall into that category, and the majority of people don't fall into that category by definition. Then actually, you might not be attracting, a diverse group of people to come on board. And then it's thinking about those individuals, those diversities, and trying to think about what it's like to walk in those people's shoes as well. And then by better understanding people, it helps you get the best out of them to think about how can I really encourage this person to contribute more or actually contribute in a more constructive, way, et cetera. And then it's really thinking about that and encouraging that so that when you are in those sort of team environments, everyone is playing a role, everyone's constructing, and actually the composite of what's being delivered is greater than the sum of the parts.
That's such good advice, though, about stepping outside of yourself essentially and putting yourself into somebody else's shoes. Where our minds are designed, we know this from studies that our minds are designed to make shortcut decisions in life, based
Right.
on, and so you're going to use your own perspective and your own
Right.
experiences to make that shortcut. And so you have to actually actively move out of your consciousness and try to think it from their perspective, as crude as that might be. You're not going to understand their full life experience, but at least give that moment so that you can say, oh, maybe this isn't making so much sense to them comparative to the way I think of it.
I totally agree. And I think what I've seen really develop a lot, especially in the last sort of 10 years, and more companies are embracing this, which is really thinking about diversity and inclusion, and having sort of employee sort of fora groups, which do talk about gender, talk about women in leadership, which do talk about race and people of different ethnic minorities, do talk about sexuality. And really sharing people's experiences about the journeys that they've been on, some of the challenges that those people have faced. And I'm a white male. I have not walked in the shoes of someone who's non-white. I haven't walked in the shoes of someone who's not male, et cetera. So it's very difficult for me to fully understand exactly what journey those individuals have been on, but actually listening and wanting to seeking to understand is really, really important, because that influences how some people interact, how they think, how they operate. And it's really important to be sensitive to that and to be open to understanding why someone might approach a situation from a different perspective. Doesn't mean to say that one is right and one is wrong. It just means to
Right.
say that there are different perspectives. And I think that's something which I really compliment organizations where there's been a real increase in that. And for me, a lot of it's about communication. It's about sharing experiences, and it's helping people understand, if you haven't walked in those shoes, this is what it feels like to walk in those shoes. So you can be more empathetic and appreciate, okay, this is some of these experiences friends, colleagues have been through. Gosh, that must have been pretty tough to
Yeah.
really understand that. But if you haven't been that person in that situation, you can't fully comprehend what was involved.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe one topic we could talk about to wrap up this segment is how to develop trust within a team. Because I don't think like all these contributions that you're talking about
Yeah.
and people feeling comfortable, I think all in the at the at the fun fundamentals of it is regarding whether people are tr feel trusted, that they trust themselves and that they trust their colleagues to a certain level. If you agree with that, what how have you seen that trust been well developed within a team? Perhaps that's just come together, where there is no trust to start with, just because it's new individuals.
So I think a couple of things. One is seeking to understand each other. So understanding each other, sharing who you are, a bit more about your style. There are various psychological things like Myers-Briggs and colors and insights, all those sort of things. But those just help to paint a bit of a picture about some of your styles, but also sharing a bit about your journey. I'm being really as open as possible about that. And I think the role of a leader is to be is to kind of role model that, and also as part of that is not to be afraid of sharing one's vulnerabilities,
Yes.
and actually also being very open to the fact that sometimes as a leader you will get things wrong. That happens. We're human beings, and therefore you will get things wrong. But also acknowledging when you get something wrong, And you know, making it acceptable for people in the team to make mistakes, because we all make mistakes. I don't believe anyone comes to work deliberately trying to make a mistake and to do a bad job. I don't believe that happens. I believe everyone comes with a positive intent, and mistakes do happen. We're human beings, and it is acknowledging that. It's providing a safe space where people are happy to acknowledge when something has gone wrong, and then provide a supportive environment. But okay, how do we learn from that? Sometimes if one person makes a mistake, it means somebody else won't make the same mistake, because you can learn from it. And it's having that sort of safe space. And I think where also, you encourage individuals to participate, to contribute, to as a leader, also to think about, if there are individuals who are being quiet, not contributing, seek to understand why they're not doing it. Try to elicit them to contribute, ask them questions, directly, to help to do that. But trust is one of these things that is easy to talk about, is very difficult to develop, and it's incredibly easy to break.
Oh, yes.
And I think a lot of this is once you've built the trust, you've then really got to walk the talk, and to ensure that you maintain the trust, because you can very quickly break it. And
Yes.
that's what you've got to look out for.
Yeah. I found when trying to develop trust in a brand new team is to demonstrate vulnerability as a
Right.
means to do that. In other words, you take the first step in being vulnerable and so that people can see what happens, kind of a thing. And then when you're the leader, then that the stakes are higher for you. And so when they see that you can successfully navigate that and it's okay, I feel like they then feel much more comfortable in being able to do also taking small risks, so to speak, until they start building. Because it's taking a small risk, seeing the results, nothing terrible happened.
Yeah,
Then
right.
further risk happens, and then all those add up into what I think is collectively then becomes trust, is a way of thinking of it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one simple way of demonstrating vulnerability is to say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. And that goes back to the point about, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And actually, as a leader, I don't have a problem putting my hand up saying, I don't know the answer to that. There are people here, in this group who are far better qualified and more knowledgeable than I am to provide an answer for that, and to provide sort of guidance on that. I guess ultimately, with a leader, he or she has to take accountability for a decision, but that's where you need to apply judgment. And if you don't know the answer, you make sure you've got someone who can help you with the answer, and then you apply judgment to it. But I think a simple way of helping to build trust is just putting your hands up and saying, I don't know the answer to that. And actually, there aren't that many leaders that do that, to be brutally honest. A lot of leaders feel uncomfortable about saying, I don't know the answer, because the expectation is that because you're the boss, you're the leader, that he or she needs to have all the answers and to tell everyone this is what you do. And I think for me, I think it's a sign of strength to put your hand up and say, I don't know. I don't know the answer. Not a sign of weakness.
I'll go so far as to say when something hasn't gone well, I'll stand up in front of my team and say, look, that didn't go as well as I had hoped. This is what I think I could have done better. This is what I've learned from this kind of a thing. And I think that maybe we could, I always find it when I do something wrong like that, not wrong, but it didn't go well, that it suggests new solutions of that things that actually probably were better in the long run. I'm actually sometimes grateful I made the mistake because sometimes it actually leads to something far better because of it.
Exactly. And I think rarely do you get something 100% right. Right. So even if you've done a piece of work, a project, an initiative, which is absolutely fantastic, there's usually one or two things that you could do differently to improve it. And I think this is, this has been well talked about in sport, with sort of, there's small incremental improvements. And I think it's a good habit to get into. And it's easy not to do, because often, when you've delivered on a project or key piece of work, actually you're there to think, gosh, that was a hard piece of work, and please, that's out of the way. And then you're busy thinking about the next piece of work, and you don't have a lot of time to sort of pause and reflect. But actually, I think it is really important, once you've done a significant piece of work, just to stop, reflect on it. What went well? What could have gone better? And there are always going to be things that could have been done better, as to think about those learnings, because often you will encounter a similar situation in the future. And how can you make it slightly easier for yourself and get a slightly better outcome by doing just one or two small things differently?
Well, Well, Michael, this has been illuminating and really entertaining to listen to. Thank you so much for contributing. You clearly have a lot of experience in this field and also in how to be a leader. And so sharing this with so many people, I'm sure will be well appreciated by the community. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Norbert. It's been a pleasure.